unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling and right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Mary Edgerton, and along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Dr. Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they are great storytellers. Rounding out our team are our chief production engineer and media director, Nicole Rocherlin. Notice how I can really pronounce her name when she's not looking at me. And our intern, Tatiana Gago. She makes me nervous. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the power of story. Stories take us on a journey where we begin to experience the world within the storyteller's world. Storytelling communicates more than words. It connects us as humans because it chronicles our lives with friends and family. Stories remind us not to let precious episodes in our life slip by because, as John Lennon put it so well, life is what happens when you are busy making other plans. I think that statement really applies during this May-June period when so many people are reaching milestones in their lives, graduations from high school, making plans for the future, and anticipating great things to come, not to mention the pressure on you for making a decision for the future. Plans are great until it keeps you from, well, living and being happy. So this is our theme tonight. And to celebrate that theme, I have a special guest with me tonight, Dr. Valencia Thomas. Dr. Thomas is from Fort Worth. I love this. She decided early on that building the house was the best part of having a dollhouse. And at the end of high school, she decided to study physics. Despite being discouraged by her guidance counselor, Val, this very bright African-American student, applied to several colleges before deciding on a place called Harvard. Okay, Val is now a dermatologist, and not just a dermatologist, but a Mohs surgeon and a dermatopathologist. And she'll explain to us in a minute what Mohs surgery is. But she's so much more than a terrific doctor. She is the consummate storyteller, and like all great tellers, she's a great story listener. And I'm lucky enough to have her listen to me. We share so many stories when I am in her office as her patient that the nurses can't finish their jobs because Valencia and I are just having too much fun with this, oh, that just reminded me, just one more story. And truth is, they enjoy listening to us, so they don't mind the interruptions. One catalyst to our stories is how similar our lives are. We have each taken twists and turns in making career decisions. Both of our life stories start with a love of physics. For us, physics answers complex questions. It's the ultimate explanation of everything. From physics, we each landed in medicine, and in the end, we share a love of pathology. Now, Val and I had lunch together on Saturday to share a few stories, and I have to tell you, 4 hours later, we had to tear ourselves apart. So you're in for a treat. We have 1 hour, but we're going to pack it in. Val, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. This is an absolutely wonderful thing that you do, and I enjoyed this immensely. Thank you.
I'm so glad. Now, I know you've been on TV. Have you been on radio?
Yes. Minimally. This is my first time in front of a microphone.
Oh, cool. Okay. It's a lot of fun. Well, so here we are, and we started by talking a little bit about how you applied to many schools, despite what your counselor told you, and just what happened? Had you been outside of Texas before that?
I had been outside of Texas to visit family in Colorado, and
Colorado's not Boston.
No, Colorado's not Boston, but really, and to visit grandparents out in California, but. Truly, my first real adventures were going on these college interviews and going and seeing these different campuses. So it was really an absolute treat to, it was really an absolute treat to get to travel and to see that things were very different in different parts of the country. In particular, Texan doesn't necessarily translate up east. So if you're saying you're going to tump it over, when it means to turn something over and you make eye contact and you say things like y'all, it's very difficult. But similarly, you don't know how to pronounce the word C-O-P-L-E-Y, because in Boston, that is Copley. That is not Copley. And you have to know not to make eye contact on the bus or the subway. That's a bad idea.
I get that. So what happened when you first got to Boston and did things like, say, Copley and and stared at the person across from you in the subway? Give us a story here.
Well, I would smile and then people would follow me. And I learned that that's not what I wanted in life. So it was a very quick learning curve in terms of the eye contact. I will say, it's funny when you... Harvard's very much a regional school, so there are a lot of New Englanders and a lot of East Coasters. So to some, and especially when you're young, you feel, I think on the East Coast, one feels as if civilization ends at the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And it really doesn't. My parents are not siblings, and we actually do have indoor plumbing, and we have all kinds of lovely things. We even have dishwashers here and parking spaces, unlike out east. So it's good. It's a trade.
I just have to throw in, I was with a group reading a letter of recommendation from the dean of MIT about a young woman from Alabama, a student at MIT who was studying physics. And it starts out, despite her lovely southern drawl, well, I'm saying in a southern accent, he's really the MIT dean, she really does more than bake cookies. And I remember the chair of our committee looked down and said, I think I need to write him a letter and tell him that we have electricity down here now. And I can relate to these things. I went to England for graduate school, and I had been out of Texas a little bit, to Colorado, to Mexico. I think that was about it. And I go over, and down in my hometown near Mexico, people hug and they lean in. And I would start to say something to somebody that I had just met, and I would lean in because, right, that's what you do. You sort of lean in and you get close to them. And they were English. They would lean back. And I learned. But besides adjusting to the culture of Boston, give us a story of what it was like studying physics at Harvard.
So I selected physics because I loved physics. I loved math. I loved the precision. I loved that we could predict where things were going based on where they had been. And so one of the reasons I selected physics was that I had support for my school. I had support for my community. I got an American Physical Society scholarship. And so when I got there, I expected the world to open up and for things to be at my fingertips. And they were. But Harvard was very much a school where opportunities are endless, but you're on your own in some ways. And so it is based on your own personal path and your own personal drive for you to find what you're looking for. So in physics, there were not a lot of women, and there certainly were no women of color in my class, or actually women, African-American women in particular, that were in physics. And it was a very interesting transition, because for the women in our physics sections, there were few of us, and for whatever reason, the men seemed to be slightly uncomfortable with it. And it was unclear at the time whether or not they were just uncomfortable with the concept of girls in the room. That was very rampant, unfortunately, first year of college. there was the question of, do you belong here? Do we fit what you expect an undergraduate physics major to look like? Mm-hmm. if you're here, what does that say about me? You can't be here. So there's certain territory as well. So being a physics major was difficult. It was beautiful in some ways in terms of what was taught. But I remember my first physics section where we walked in and the head teaching fellow was talking about traveling in a rocket ship at the speed of light. And if you held up a mirror, which is going to need, you know, supposed to see yourself in the mirror in theory, if you held up a mirror, would you see yourself is the question. And I still remember asking at the end of class, so do I see myself? Because the question is, can light actually travel faster than the speed of light in an absolute system? Of course, this is just, you know, this got me a lot of dates at dinner parties, you know, asking questions like this and small talk. It actually didn't. I just want to confirm that did not work.
Did he answer you?
Yeah, no, he didn't answer me. He just sighed, just closed the book and walked out the door. Being a physics major at Harvard as an African-American woman was difficult. And I remember things started to get more and more difficult when the men of the group would feel more comfortable talking to other men. And the women, we would cluster and we would sometimes be in co-ed groups, but the vast majority of men were in these male-only groups. And I remember things started to drift and the inclusion started to get smaller. And then one day, after doing my problem set with my lovely co-ed group, I saw a grade that my co-physics major had, and she had an A on her problem set that we had stayed up all night together doing. And I had a D on mine. And I thought, well, this isn't right. So I asked to see her paper. I took it up to our section leader. This wasn't the professor. This was the small group sessions where we go through things. And I said, well, what's the difference between these two papers? And he looked at it and he said, well, I guess it could give you 30 or 40 points. And that wasn't right. This was a male teaching assistant who was a PhD there. He was an international student from a place where there are very few African Americans. And it was just like a blow to the gut. So I went back to my dorm where it was wonderful that we had an assistant dean with us as one of our resident assistants, the RAs. And so I reported it. We got whatever grades adjusted that needed to be adjusted. And then I switched sections. But that was a final blow in an environment where there wasn't real mentorship that was on an active side, on an active scale. And I had already started to drift back. My primary goal of going into physics and studying the sciences was to apply it to people. I wanted to build that hand, that Luke Skywalker hand that was cut off in Return of the Jedi. That's why I did this. And so there were other places. I ended up in biochemistry where I could apply the sciences and be in a nurturing environment where people actually acted like I belonged there. But that was a very major part of how I ended up there.
So I have to tell you, I studied physics also, and I just loved it when I went for my first surgery with you, and we start talking, and you're like, oh, yeah. I said, she's like, I studied physics, and I'm like, I studied physics. And then, you know, we got off on how much we loved physics. I have to say, it was here in Texas. It was at UT Austin, and I was the only female in my class. There were no African-Americans in the class. Everybody was pretty ethnically Caucasian and middle Texas. But they were gender blind. I had great mentorship from my professors. And in fact, I still see them regularly. And it's been 40 years. I have a very good friend, Jim Thompson. I'm going to say his name because he's just such a wonderful mentor. And I'm close friends with his family. It was after I left UT, which was like just a wonderful place to be in that physics department, and I went to graduate school, and suddenly it was like, well, you're the first woman in our lab, and we weren't going to allow you, but I decided it's okay. And then information about what was happening in the lab would pass around to everybody else, and I would be the last to know. And if I published a paper before the young male graduate student, and so they all the guys said to me, well, you didn't do the work. And so I felt that it was dishonest for me to have my name first on this paper, so I insisted it be second. Well, then when the young male graduate student writes a paper, I said, but he didn't really do that work. And they said, oh, well, but it's our practice to put the graduate student's name up front. And I thought, why not me? And there's more. I don't want to get into it, but I was really unprepared after UT Austin for the subsequent harassment in grad school, in academic research, working in industrial research, and what I refer to now as female subtraction vision in the academic setting. And I think we'll address that a little bit more in the future. So it can be very discouraging, and I'm going to say especially for a young person starting out. And even now, for me, close to retirement, I'd like to be recognized for what I have done. So, yeah, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. But I want to say to everybody out there, I can't say it's perfect now, but it gets a little better, it gets a little better, it gets a little better, and keep reacting to it. But let's get back to your plans and how they worked out. So, from physics, you decided to go to medical school, and what happened next? And don't let me forget, by the end of this show, our audience is going to know what a Mohs surgery is.
It's good. It's all about details. So I decided to go to medical school, and I went to University of Chicago. And as soon as I got there, I knew that I was going to do something with my hands. I love to build, and I love to paint, and I love to draw, and I knew whatever I was going to do was going to be with my hands. And so as a first-year medical student, I asked for a female mentor who was a surgeon. And still, those were the days when there weren't a lot of female surgeons. And I was paired with this fantastic surgeon, Dr. Kirsten Stinson, who's at University of Chicago, and she is just the best. And she let this medical student tag along with her. And I saw what I consider to be miracles happen. I remember this one patient who had a paralysis of a vocal cord, and so he spoke in a whisper. And with him awake, with the proper anesthesia, she was able to make a little hole in his cartilage in his neck as he's awake, and she pushed in this little Gore-Tex block and asked him to say the word he over and over again. And you would hear this whisper, this he, as he had his vocal cord, the paralyzed vocal cord moved back to the midline so the other vocal cord can come and make sound. So I was sold. I loved it. And I thought I was going to definitely do that path. But I imprinted on head and neck oncology. I was always fascinated by cancers and how cancers affected people. And I learned that for every op, there's post-op. And so there were these major heroic surgeries that would take place, and you can resect a tumor, but the impact on life and survival is so great that people did not necessarily make it through the post-operative period. There was a lot of depression and suicide for some of these patients who went from being a normal 20-year-old young woman to having her lower jaw removed and for a cancer that she did nothing to get. And that cost was very high, and I wasn't sure I could continue with that particular path, knowing that one day, as things evolved, there would be other options. So then I was thrown in a horrible tailspin. I had no idea what to go into. If I wasn't going to do this head and neck thing, then oh my gosh. So I sprayed the field. I had backup for head and neck. I had surgery. Backup for surgery. I had medicine. The anesthesiologists were always really cool. I could do that. And then I thought, you know, I'm really interested in women's health. And I thought, you know what? OBGYN, but in particular reproductive endocrinology, because it had this mix of medicine and surgery. I thought, you know, all of these things, but I just kind of sprayed the field. And I remember one day I was talking to the chair of anesthesiology, and he was such a gracious doctor, and Michael Roizen, and I had a meeting with him, and he said, so you're interested in anesthesiology? And I said to him, I have no idea. I'm confused. I'm a fourth year, and I'm about to graduate, and I've applied to everything. And he said to me, I said, I don't know what to do. And he said to me, you know, whatever decision you make, it's going to be wrong. You don't have the time or the information. So just pick something and change it later. These aren't decisions you can't undo. Just go ahead and do it. And so up to that point, everyone had been telling me I'd make the right decision, but I knew they were wrong. He was the first person to actually tell me the truth and tell me I was going to mess this up. And I knew it. So I just owned it, and I decided, by golly, I'm going to be an obstetrician, well, or reproductive endocrinologist. That was a very short-lived career. But that got me through medical school, and I matched in OBGYN. And the first day I got there, there were a number of signs that it wasn't quite right for me. Mainly, I was interested in the babies, and then they kept taking them out of the room. And so that wasn't good. And then many joke that you choose a medical field according to the body fluid that you can tolerate. So I realize I can tolerate less than I thought. And then, once I got there, it was after the first real month, I realized, you know, I don't think this is the right fit for me. It was emotionally trying. And there is, as a specialist in abnormal labor and abnormal delivery, sometimes the joyous moments are difficult to find because you are there for the complicated moments. So, there is a lot of work with children that you didn't think you would ever have to do. And I thought, you know, maybe law, but no matter what, I'm going to finish this year. I'm going to be the best resident I could possibly be, and I'm leaving. and at that point I decided, you know, I do need the time and information. So I applied for research and for education. Both would defer my medical school loans. And I decided, you know, I'm just going to have to do this. And one of the fields that I hadn't really looked at previously was dermatology. And that was just on the list. And I thought, well, I'm going to be applying to law school anyway, so let's do this. and then I had a wonderful, this concept of flow, where if you make one right decision, others will fall.
Oh, a domino effect.
Yes, yes. And so I had a little bit of that happen fortuitously. So first I quit my job. And then I decided to take a job in anything that would have me. And then I went to my college reunion, my five-year reunion. And I went there and I was so sad because I really didn't have a future that was clearly planned at that point. And it was wonderful because everyone had just quit their jobs. That was a good
and,
party.
And, you know, I have to say, I think for us, having studied physics, and as you mentioned before, physics is wonderful because it explains what's coming next. And so we grew up saying, oh, I love this field because now I can understand the world and predict it, and everything is going to be predictable. And then all of a sudden we find ourselves in this position where I don't know what I want to do next, and it's not predict. I can't say that what I did before has anything to do with what I want to do next.
Yes, yes.
But I think I just want to point out, this is a really important message for people who are feeling pressured to make a decision about what they want to do for the rest of their lives, is start something. And hey, it may be the wrong decision. It's nice if you say, hey, I could take this as the wrong decision, and if it's the right decision, I'll stick with it. But if it's the wrong decision, that's no problem. And I tell my kids when they start something, I said, look, you can do anything for a year. Even if you hate it, you can do anything for a year. Renewable up to 5 years. And at 5 years, if you are still not happy with it, change. So let me take a little moment for station identification. I used to love that when I used to hear that on the radio as a kid. Time for station identification, and here I am doing it. It's an exciting moment for me. So we are here on So What's Your Story, broadcast live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. at KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Or take it live streaming from kpft.org. We all look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. And we're going to hear a little bit more from Tatiana and Nicole about the storytelling scene and where we fit into it. But for just a moment, I see three of y'all in the engineer's room. Greg Audell is there, changed career a few times. Nicole is there. Just talked about changing her career and recently graduated from college. Tatiana
again.
Is there.
Again. Second
again.
Time.
Second time. Right, right. And Tatiana is there, who is a student in college. What do you think of this story?
You know, I actually relate to this one because I wanted to be in pathology. I used to be a biology major, but then I realized I'm not very good in science. My whole family, they're in medicine, so I was inspired. But then I realized, you know, I'm not really fit for this. It's not my calling. So, had to go to communication.
Hey, but you're doing great at it. And you, Nicole?
Well, I hate to say this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I was a stripper, but...
No, you weren't.
I was tired of making $10 out of quarter nickels, dimes, and some pennies. So I was like, you know
guys,
what?
She's fooling you. She worked
Let
in
me
healthcare.
Go get this education. No, I went to school forever because I wanted to get my BSN to transition to a nurse practitioner because I wanted to go into medicine and open our own practice with my brother, who was a physician in the military, who was going to get out. And then when I left my husband, hallelujah, I had a change of heart. And I realized my passion was communication. And I've been... You know, putting the pedal to the floor since then. So
and you have been soaring, I have to say, or speeding, however you want to put it, going faster than the speed of light on that way.
You know, it took me by surprise as well, but it started with Dr. Rubicek and KPFT being here and just understanding and knowing where my gifts really lies, because I didn't know where I was going to go, but I just was praying and fasting and God was speaking to me, communication. And that's the route that I took. And I've learned so much about myself. I learned so much about it. And now I do plan, although I do have my own business, which is really rising. I am going to go back for my master's in leadership and also mass communication.
Excellent. And Greg, how about you? So, and Floyd, of course.
And Floyd. Floyd is pretty content in his current career, which is watching over me. It's a full-time job. The pay isn't that well, but the benefits are good, and he gets free food 24/7. As for me, as you mentioned, you know, I've had a number of different careers, and I think we just live in an age where we no longer have to be married to one from the age of 18 on. You know, we live longer, we're exposed to more, and there's so many interesting things to explore that if something strikes my fancy and if I think I have the skill and the connections to do it, I'm going to go for it. I'm not going to let it be a passing fantasy.
So I have to tell you, I started in physics as an undergraduate. I did biophysics as a graduate student. I did 2 years of postdocing, and then I went to work for Exxon for 4 years and then Mobil for 5 years. This is when they were still separate companies. Doing mathematical modeling, more along physics lines, and then I said, I'm going to medical school. And by the time I started my residency, I was 37 years old. But...
Well, my mother graduated from law school at 50 and couldn't decide whether to go, and my grandmother said to her, well, you're going to be 50 either way. You're either going to have a law degree or you're not going to have a law degree.
Okay, well, let's get back to some of these storytelling venues. We've each told you a little story about ourselves, and to say to all those new graduates, hey, hang in there. You can be whatever you want to be. Okay, Tatiana and Nicole, so what's happening in storytelling in Houston?
Well, let me say first something about our show. If you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing it, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org or with Facebook Live on our So What's Your Story Facebook page. But yes, there are some other important storytelling venues in and around town. Let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them because this is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just go to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset. Go to their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org. For upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program.
And that is one of my favorite places to go, and I just pull up any one of our stories, one I might have heard before, one I haven't heard before. I pour myself a glass of wine, and I just sit and listen because I just love listening to stories. Okay, sorry to interrupt. Let's go on. This is how it is with Valencia and I when she's operating on me. And it's like, sorry to interrupt, but, you know, before you sew me up, let me just tell you this, you know? Okay.
Well, before we go on, I know we say we are live on Facebook. We are not tonight. We're having a couple technical difficulties, but it's no excuse not to pull it up and rewind, replay if you want to on the Houston Storytellers website. So don't forget to check that out. But let me tell you, we also post on YouTube, so check out our program clips there, and you can tell us exactly what you are thinking about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise that we'll get right back to you. Make sure, please be sure to share our page with your friends because they're gonna thank you for it. And oh yes, we'd love it if you like us before you leave. And we don't want to miss out on our friends at the Moth Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. And that is coming up this week. The theme is going to be endings. Ooh, endings through. Even though, you know, I'm sorry, that hit home. I love a good ending. The opposite of beginning leads to new beginnings. So go for it, storytellers, and we'll be tuning in.
And we've been telling you a lot about endings and beginnings, with one just happening right after the other. Well, hey, what's happening next week on KPFT? I know it's Greg. Any of you guys know anything?
Well, Mary E., you know, I do believe that we do have Greg Audell and Floyd the Wonder Dog next week. So I know Floyd likes to play his cards close to his chest, just like he's sitting over here in the studio on Greg. So we will have to wait and see who he has next week. But I do know it's going to be a good one. So Greg and Floyd know so many fascinating people. So I know it will be just as fascinating.
Fascinating people: Barbara Bush, George Bush, Bill
Nicole
Clinton.
Rochelin.
Nicole Rochelin, yes. Ella Fitzgerald. It just goes on and on. You can mention a name, and it's like, you know, I met her one time. I'm like, wow.
He does. I hope. Yeah. I need some pictures for proof because he just met everybody. I'm a little jealous. It's okay.
Okay. So back to our show here. So Val, I know that I was not in your office for any OB work this last week. So you found dermatology. You thought it was interesting. So what'd you do with it?
So what I did with dermatology is I stayed on the same cricket path that I had started with all of my decision making in terms of career. So when I got to the research position that I got into as I was thinking about the LSAT, I learned I really like this visual stuff, and I really like being able to diagnose diseases and have all these complex medical pathways come together in certain patterns.
I need to intersect something.
Of course.
This is a stage whisper to the audience. Physicists make the best pathologists. Okay. Okay. Go on.
Well, that's what I'd love to be biased and say yes. So when I got to dermatology, you really can't run from yourself. And so I loved the research. I decided to apply. I was able to get a position, which was lovely. And it was and that's another story. There are so many nested stories, so much to say. But once I got to dermatology, I found myself, remember, very early on, there was an excision, and a doctor was taking something off of someone's shoulder, and we're just superficial. We do everything under local. People are talking to you. You're talking to the patient. Sometimes they eat during the surgery. It's good times. We keep our surgical area sterile, but otherwise it's a pretty laid-back environment. And I remember something was pumping this little tiny blood vessel, and I walked into the room and I said, well, you want me to ligate that? And then the professor said, sure. And so, yeah, I went in and I had 300 C-sections under my belt. So I was pretty good at that. So I tied it up and I just kind of stepped back the way you normally do in an OR. And I realized, oh, I like this. And so when I found that on the days when I went to work and I was doing nothing but procedures, primarily excisions or doing laser surgery and having that intersection of applied physics, that light that we were using to ablate cells and to get certain effects, I was the happiest, and I could go home and still be myself and still be a person. And so what I decided to do is do something called Mohs surgery, where it's a minimally invasive sort of skin cancer surgery, usually performed on the head, neck, hands, feet, and genitalia for common skin cancers that grow in one little plant mass. They have to grow in one section. And our job is to basically put in a little bit of anesthesia, take what we see, and then hand it to a technician who will process the tissue while you're waiting. Usually takes about an hour or so, and then we'll hand you the slides, and then you go in as the pathologist to read these slides, and you do this serial removal until the tumor is gone. And it's named after Fred Mohs. He was a surgeon who decided that the surgeons can get a better outcome if the surgeon is the pathologist and they ink the tissues differently than they normally are. The standard inking process is to take a specimen and basically cut it like a loaf of bread and look at a few sections and estimate the margin. But in Mohs, you treat the tumor like a Reese's peanut butter cup, and you just take off the wrapper and you say, is there any tumor coming through this? And so you get some good cure rates. It's quite nice.
That's a good way to put it. I just had a Mohs. I'm getting my stitches off tonight. But unfortunately, we're not live on television. Otherwise, yes, we would be doing it this way. So, you know, medicine, I have found, is not the tiniest of worlds. And I have to tell you, make friends with everybody you know, because you just never know what the next institution, if they might be your boss. And it's small enough that I actually know people who did DermPath fellowships at Mass General Hospital during those years where you were studying. So Steve Lyle. Yes. You know Steve Lyle?
He's fantastic.
Yeah, Steve Lyle was a resident with me at the University of Pennsylvania, and he lived about two blocks from me. And Alex Lazar.
Oh, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and Alex works at MD Anderson now. But tiny world is one thing. So what I know about dermatology, what we used to say when we were in medical school, you know, the field of medicine, what's the basic law of the field of medicine? If what you're doing is working, keep doing it. If what you're doing is not working, change it. And above all, never trust your patient to a surgeon. And the law of dermatology is, if you don't know what it is, don't touch it. And if you know what it is, you don't have to touch it.
I've never heard that, but that sounds really accurate.
But so from Mohs, you circled back around to pathology, which I find interesting, because as a physicist, I find pathology is very scientific. There's a cause, there's an effect. You try to figure out why these things happened. We call it the etiology. What is the etiology? Why did this happen? And it encompasses the study of pathways, but in a very mechanistic fashion, of not just it's turned on, it's turned off, but how do they interact, and quantitatively how do we get these cells that are proliferating out of context. So how did you get back to pathology? How did that go?
By accident. So I always loved pathology. When I was a resident, we were rotating. We have core rotations through pathology, and I did not have my dedicated skin pathology, also known as dermatopathology, rotation until after I had actually gotten a position in surgery. So I got to it and I thought, this is so logical and clean. And a lot of the really stellar dermatologists that I'd worked with in the past were also trained as pathologists. There's a path where you can do dermatology and then do a pathology fellowship and read these cells and read the skin, and it's just this kind of unified field. So I thought, no one's going to do two fellowships. Who does that? And so I went on to my surgery, and it was fantastic. And I got my first job. I worked at Yale University. I was their Mohs surgeon for a couple of years. And I remember this one case that came in, and it was a gentleman who came in with what looked like a textbook squamous cell carcinoma, which are these very common skin cancers that can be low risk when small. And I removed it, and I performed a frozen biopsy just like I knew how. And instead of it having all the features of a non-melanoma skin cancer, it turns out it was a melanoma, which changes the entire game. Melanomas behave according to how deep they are in the skin, and they have the potential to spread. It's one of our most deadly forms of cancer. So it really struck me this at my core that the pathology that's at the center of what I do, I want to have stronger. And so, in a kind of strange turn of events, I decided, you know what? I think it's time to get some more learning, some more book learning, because, you know, there's nothing like a paycheck. But I decided, let's do this. And I came back to my home state, and I was fortunate enough to train with a similarly trained Mohs surgeon, dermatopathologist, my boss, Dr. Ron Rapini. He's my chair. And I remember when we first met, he said, you know, not a lot of people are like us. And so, but it was wonderful. And I found my way back to that simple logic and this pure science of the cells and watching cellular behavior and understanding diseases from the perspective of the building blocks. So it's very much reminiscent of the physics of my yesteryear.
So did you see the movie The Theory of Everything?
Yes.
About Steve Hong? Yeah, that was a great movie. And I love the name of it. And so when I came out of medical school, and I did a year of internal medicine, and I was going to be a cardiologist. Now, take into account that I was 38 years old when I was starting my residency, because I had gone back to medical school, which means, you know, guys, you can change. You can change. And so I was facing 6 years, 3 years of internal medicine and 3 years of cardiology. And actually, I had had my first child as a fourth-year medical student, and I was on call, and I really missed my baby, and I was making a call to the pathologist who was on call that night because we needed to give a platelet transfusion to a leukemic patient. And inside the hospital, you would have a single ring. If somebody called you from outside, it was a double ring. And there I'm sitting there kind of feeling sorry for myself because here I am on call and I'm trying to do something for this patient, but I got to go through this level of approvals. And so I paged the pathologist, and the call that came back was a double ring. And I said, that was my favorite subject. That was my favorite thing to do. And they take call from home. What am I doing?
Very smart.
And yes. And I think also it's part of the theory of everything is you go back to pathology and it's all about disease processes from a very molecular and basic point of view. Okay. So to my radio listeners, is this not that life is what happens to you while you're busy making plans? I'm going to be a physicist. Well, no, I end up being a doctor. Well, I'm going to be an OBGYN. Well, no, I end up being a dermatologist. Well, I'm going to be a Mohs surgeon. Well, I end up being a dermatopathologist also. So one thing, you have, Val, showed us how empowered you have felt in making choices to reach the one that you loved. So did you encounter anything in your field that feels like your physics days, that to say today? I mean, you're very successful. You have great credentials. You have great patients.
I have the best patients.
Yes, we know I'm one of them, but okay. but is this, are there any barriers? Especially for an African-American woman.
Of course, but that happens. You know, I'm happy to be here, and this is the package I came in, but it's not always the package that people expect. So I think that if people close their eyes and they hear, oh, this doctor's coming on in, and they're a Harvard-trained doctor, and they have a couple of specialties, and they're from Texas, and they work in Texas, and you open your eyes, I don't think anyone's expecting to see me. so it makes sense that sometimes people have this type of kind of package vision of what they are expecting. But I will tell you, it comes in all different shapes and sizes where we're always dealing with certain types of interactions of expectations. One of my favorite things to do is, especially during interview season, when the dermatology residents, prospective residents who are interviewing to get a slot, come to my excision clinic and they are assigned to come and work with Dr. Thomas for an afternoon. And I wear scrubs every day and I match the uniform of the various medical assistants and nurses who are around in the clinic. And when you're not expecting to see me and I'm sitting among my wonderful coworkers who really keep everything running and I couldn't do anything without them, and I see this young doctor walk in a white coat looking very eager, and I'll say hi, and they look me over because they don't know who I am, but they just assume that I'm not the doctor and I'm just, I don't know who they think I am, but they just go in the corner and they look me over and they say nothing and they sit. And they sit and I see them and I just turn back and have my conversations. And then eventually someone will say, oh, Dr. Thomas, someone's ready in room one. And all of a sudden that student will stand up and be very, very attentive suddenly. And I'll think to myself, you're dead to me. I'll still teach you.
Right.
You know, if you have to know how I am useful to you before you can respect me, then we are not going to get along. So
I think that's a great story. So I think I have some time to tell you how I became honored by the great pathologist, if there's any pathologist out there. She's a thyroid pathologist and endocrine pathologist, Dr. Virginia Lavolsi, famous among people. And when a woman had been difficult in pathology, she made a little card that had a picture of a phoenix on it. And you would open it up and say, you are DWIP. VAL, those were her initials. And it was a great honor. So one day, I'm a resident, and I'm cutting, I don't know what, hepatitis C livers. And I did my residency in the early 90s in Philadelphia. There was a lot of HIV. There was a lot of hepatitis C. And so you'd be gowned and covered in, you know, double gloved and dealing with these bloody specimens. And this call comes through the intercom that says, you know, call for Dr. Edgerton, call for Dr. Edgerton. I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to say darn, but I was thinking something else. Because I have to take off all the bloody stuff. Because you're not supposed to touch the phone with your bloody gloves because you put your phone up to your face. But at the same time, I need to put on new gloves because who knows if somebody did touch that phone with their bloody gloves sometime. So I de-gown, de-glove, put on new gown and gloves, walk over to pick up the phone. This guy's been waiting, and I said, hello. And this guy says, damn it! I asked for Dr. Edgerton, and they just sent me right back to the front office. Oh. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, damn it, too. And I said, do you think every woman's voice is a secretary? This is Dr. Edgerton. And there was silence. And then he says, oh, no. My mother's a doctor. You know, my sister's a doctor. You know, I love doctors. I know women can be doctors. And I was like, Anyway, I answered his question. And when I came out and told Dr. Lavolsi about it, I got one of the DWIP cards, which is in my safe, because it is very, very special. Well, I tell you, I think we have time for another story. And how about a takeaway lesson on skincare?
Yes.
Right. So is there some derm advice you can give us?
Yeah. So the simple things are, don't cook yourself. That's number one. That's the easiest. You want to not burn. Burning is a sign that you've cooked yourself too much and your poor skin is dying. Avoid tanning beds. Very important advice. Sunscreen is important for everybody, for fine lines and wrinkles, also to prevent those, but also to prevent the type of changes that ultraviolet radiation can cause in cells to make the cells grow when they're not supposed to. Because when they grow when they're not supposed to, sometimes that's cancer. So we want to avoid all of those. But if you are in the preventative side of things, if you can use sunscreen and use a retinoid, especially on the face, retinoids are these vitamin A containing compounds. They're that retinoic acid that you'll hear a lot about, and they're putting it everywhere in cosmetics and in topicals. And basically, retinoids do help prevent fine lines and wrinkles. They can help in acne and treating acne. They can even skin tone. But more importantly, they can slow down how quickly cells divide so that they have a chance to heal themselves. So if you couple that with sunscreen, you can look very young for a very long time. And it's not about how you look, but gosh darn it, it helps if you can look good too. So so those are the main things. Drink water. Wear sunscreen. You know, avoid, you know, tanning beds. Because you don't want to grow a cancer where the sun don't shine.
So I didn't have tanning beds. I just grew up in South Texas when we had Sea and Ski, which was SPF 5. So did you ever have an experience with retinoids?
Yes, I did. I have. It's one of my most cherished memories. I had gone back to my old stomping grounds of San Diego, where I did my OB internship and was happy to leave. And I was visiting one of my friends who was in town, and she was a resident, and it was Valentine's Day, and she got home from this horrible long OB rotation. We thought, well, we're two single ladies on the town. Let's see if we can go out, just do something. So we ended up at this dance club called The Bitter End. It was just the two of us. And of course, she's exhausted. And we weren't planning on doing anything. And so we walk into this Valentine's Day club, and there's nobody there. And there's this dance club downstairs, and the basement's dark. And we decide, well, let's just dance. There's just two of us. We'll just get on the floor and act a fool. And so in walks this young woman who's beautiful with these three Adonises around her, and they all these guys are dancing around her. And we thought, gosh, some girls have all the luck. Well, she looks up at me, and I look up at her, and she says, Val. And I said, Kelly. Turns out we went to medical school together, and these were these beautiful flight surgeons that she had at the Balboa Medical Center with her. But now we have three girls and three boys, and we danced the night away. It is so fantastic, and it was so much fun, and I was on cloud nine. And so I went to the powder room just because it was that time of the night, and I looked in the mirror, and it turns out that I did not know you should stop your retinoid about a week before you get your eyebrows done. And earlier that day, I had gotten my eyebrows waxed, and by golly, there were two giant black scabs where my eyebrows were supposed to be, and that wasn't good. And then I realized, I have to get out of this dance club before these dudes actually see what my face looks like. So I run back down and I grab my friend. I said, my friend also, interestingly, whose name was Kelly. I shook her. I said, Kelly, we've got to leave before the lights come on. And then, of course, right at that moment, the lights come on and I have to throw my elbow over my eyes like I'm a Dracula. And I'm like, oh, the light's so bright. Let's get outside to the dark street. And so, I never saw those guys again, but I do have eyebrows that have grown back.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So anybody out there who ever uses retinoids, do remember that. I mean, that just sounds like Cinderella.
Yeah, it was the worst kind of Cinderella. It was definitely, emphasis on cinder.
Okay. Oh, gosh, this has been so much fun. We are coming to the close of our evening, and I do hope that everybody has not just enjoyed the stories as stories, but anybody who's looking at their life and wondering if they might make a change, takes this as an inspiration to make a change. You can reinvent yourself. This is not a problem. Now, there's one thing I like to do at the end of my show. Do you have anybody in Radio Land you want to say goodnight to?
Hi, Mom! Cliche. I want to say hi to everyone. I want to say hi to my sisters. Hi, Dad. Dads never get enough love. And little baby Elizabeth, how are you doing? That's my niece. She's wonderful. My sister Dee and my sister Kim and her husband Jamal. Hi, everybody.
Well, thank you. And I think back there that we have a special piece of music. And
that's right. I'm going to serenade you guys along with Dr. Hank Rubicek and Greg Audell.
Well, okay. If y'all are going to do it for us, go for it. Okay. John Lennon wrote a beautiful song to his young son, Sean, and talked about how life happens while you're busy making other plans. So you're looking around. Don't miss the life. Don't miss the life stories. And so can we hear Beautiful Boy?
All right, time's up.
Time's up. Closing music, Beautiful Boy. Hey, 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 everybody.
This is the intro.
Okay. Don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. And this is Mary Edgerton, along with my guests, Dr. Valencia Thomas and the rest of the So What's Your Story team. And especially from tonight's stories, we want you to never forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Say a little prayer. Every day, in every way, it's getting better and better.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there. Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream.
new and improved. Get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not, nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT, Houston.
Hey, this is KPFT, Houston.
Hello, it's that vinyl show.